Session number 8277, Jack Calloway, part one.
Could you tell me something about your background before the war, Mr. Calloway?
Well, I originally went to India with my father, who was in the artillery, and we went to Karachi.
What year was that?
That 1908, October. And in due time, when I was 10 then, and at 14, I joined the Royal Artillery Depot, Trumpeters Depot, at Kirkee.
What was life like as a young boy?
Well, I was very small, of course, and it was a mounted corps, Royal Field Artillery, horse artillery, horses, you see, and I was really scared stiff of horses, but still, I soon had to get used to them. By the time the war broke out, I had already been posted as a trumpeter to the 82nd Field Battery, which was in the station, Kirkee. So I had about 3 months as a trumpeter before the war broke out, as at regular duty. And by October, we were away.
Just before we get on to the actual war, I'd like to ask you a little bit about... Yeah. Life in the barracks.
Depot, yes.
Can you remember?
We had a really full training, gymnastics and all this carry on, as well as riding, of course. Riding was the big factor. I was scared stiff of horses, but there were 360 horses in the ammunition column from where we used to get our horses, and we weren't supposed to come on parade with the same one more than once. In other words, we had to ride anything. But it was great fun, and there was an enclosed riding school there in Kirkee where they used to hold all the,
Gymkhanas?
Rough riders were special people who had special training as horse management. They used to come every 2 years there. And we were used to tail in behind them with all the... And they used to get new horses from Australia. They always came from Australia. And they'd collect them when they arrived and break them in. And we used to tail on in that course at the final stages. So that we got a good grounding in riding. And in due course we passed out and went to our batteries wherever they were needed. And as I say, I was in the 82nd Field Battery by the time the war broke out. And
You mentioned you were a bugler.
Well, it's a trumpeter, you see. We trumpet and bugle we used to carry. Trumpet on the back and the bugle under the arm. We had quite a long session at trumpet and bugle training. It wasn't a... As simple as that, if you had never blown an instrument before. But the training...
How were you trained in it?
We had a trumpet major who was a warrant officer, you know, like an RSM. And he was an experienced trumpeter from... Actually, he was from the African War, South Africa. Kettleband was his name. And he was extremely good. And he'd been... trumpeter out there to one of the generals, I can't remember which, in those days. But he trained us all very well, and I met him after the war when I went back to India, and he died out there in due course. But a grand old chap.
Did you find it reasonably easy to pick up the trumpet and the bugle?
No, not at first, because I'd never had played any instrument of any kind. But it was getting the lips hardened, which was the great thing. But
are there any special tricks for that, or
no? Just constant practice, and a few whacks on the knuckles for not getting it right.
Where did you practice? You kind of been popular.
No, well, we used to go out onto the open fields, Maidan we called it, way out from the barracks, and we could blow our trumpets to the full extent. There was no problem. But the great thing was there was a polo field there with a shed, a galvanised polar shed. And the great trick was to get us to be sounding straight up against the shed so the echo came back, which was very funny, really. But it enabled us to get our lips hardened and to sound clearly. That is to say, you tongue the notes properly, you know, instead of blurring them. But we all passed out in due course, and each year there were more boys coming in and going.
How many calls, trumpet calls, did you have to learn?
Well, there's about 54 altogether, trumpet and bugle calls of different kinds. But not all that number were used normal regularly. I mean, there was a call for almost everything. Wagons left, wagons right, all this carry on in the field, which of course was never used.
And it wasn't?
No, and when we went overseas, of course, that was the last thing you did was to blow a trumpet or a bugle anywhere. The thing was a farce.
Did you realise this while you were doing your trumpet training?
No.
It would never be used?
No, well, no idea at all. Even the people who were had knowledge of the South African War, they didn't mention it, but I don't suppose it worried them too much there. But it was a different kettle of fish with us. We had to be quiet. That was the... moving around in the desert like that, as we had to, be very quietly done, because you could hear it at night. Terrific. Surprising.
So you did use the bugle and the trumpet for peacetime calls?
Oh, yes, yes, only in peacetime, that's right. And why we went overseas is a mystery, because except to sound the last post over people who were being buried after various battles.
While you were at training as a trumpeter, were you still living with your family in the barracks, or had you been...
Oh, no, no, my family were in Bombay, you see, and I was in Pune, Kirki.
So you were in the barracks. Who were you barracked with?
We were with the ammunition column people, and one NCO was responsible for us.
Were you were the boys segregated from the men?
Separate from... Oh, yes, we had our own rooms there for the boys.
What were conditions like?
16 boys. Same as for the ordinary troops. Exactly the same arrangements.
Well, could you describe that?
Well, in those days, we had Indian cooks to produce the food, and we had the khaki steak, as they called it. Everyone, you were entitled to a pound of meat a day, that sort of thing, pound of bread. But there was no messing on the in the way that it's been done today. Nothing like it at all. It was really very rough.
How about sleeping arrangements, sir?
Sleeping, well, we had the iron... trellis cots with iron stand legs, you know. And you could lift the iron cot up and in order to bang the bugs out in various times.
Were bugs a problem in the barracks?
At times, yes. And we used to have to treat them by knocking them out, banging the beds about.
How did you... You came from a military family, so
yes.
I suppose you were used to discipline in a sense, but
yes.
Did the army life, the discipline of it, did it suit you at the time?
I didn't mind it. I was quite happy, and we were treated well. Discipline was a great thing, and naturally, I mean, if you were supposed to be doing a certain thing, well, you expected to be doing it.
Did you have any contacts with besides your cooks, the local Indian population?
Only like we would normally have done anywhere, with people. But we had no sort of special entertainment or anything of that. In those days, there were no cinemas in the country. I mean, occasionally a bioscope, I used to call it a bioscope, would come along, and perhaps once a year, and they'd set up tents and show some pictures or something like that. There was very little of that.
But did you actually... Were relations good with the local Indians? Were they friendly?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Very good. And I'm sure they all miss us and we miss them, in that sense.
The climate, had you got accustomed to it?
Yes. Oh, yes. Because we'd been to Aden with my father. We're 2 years in Aden. And back to Karachi, and then I... We went over to Bombay, and then I joined the army. So in that time...
How did you feel when you first heard war had broken out?
Oh, well, everybody was excited. Let's get at it, you see. Let's get at them. In those days, it was something, you see. But the great crib was who was going to be off first, you see. We were at Pune, Kirki Pune, and the brigade there, we were simply waiting for a division to be organized, in other words, and I suppose that the Mesopotamian campaign had probably not been envisaged in the immediate outbreak of war, so it was a couple of months before we moved.
Were you hoping to come back to fight the Germans originally, or...?
No. Nothing of that. We never got out of Mesopotamia.
No, yes, I mean, you know, when you first heard war declared...
Oh, I see.
..and Turkey wasn't in it,
we had no idea. The only thing was that one battery from our brigade was taken away to replace one that was held up at Bombay with laryngitis or something with the horses. They couldn't go on. So one of our batteries was taken from the brigade, and the 81st battery came back from Bombay and stayed with us until they were fit again.
Had you by now learnt any gun crew drill?
No. Not myself as a trumpeter. But I could... as a matter of fact, we had knowledge of the loading and what have you of the guns, of course.
What happened when you actually left for Mesopotamia? Can you remember?
Well, we all our private belongings had to be boxed and packed and left, accounted for, to be sent on to our relatives. But and eventually my box of stuff was sent to my parents in Bombay, and they had it when I came back. But then we were taken up with the question of entraining and loading and getting to Bombay and getting in the ship, and all that. It was quite a job, getting the horses into the trucks and so on, and offloading them and slinging them into the ship. Gosh, somewhere we could, certain levels we could function, take them up onto the ship, you know, through a ramp. But others had to be lifted through
into the holds,
yes. And these were Australian cattle ships that we went in, especially fitted, you see, to take all the horses. In those days, of course, the horses came from Australia for all the artillery in India as they needed them. So they were mostly Australian horses that we had.
I expect the horses didn't like being winded.
No, poor devils, because they were in the heat so much and sweating like the devil. And, of course, they couldn't be exercised. They were boarded in, you see, like stacking them in. It was dreadful for them, with just a trough thing in front, so that they could be watered and fed. And with standing about, their legs began to swell, many of them, so we had to try and exercise them on deck, which was a hell of a do. Could only do so many a day. We were about 16 days before we got off the ship.
Did any of them die while they were on board?
Well, several of them had accidents and tripped over, slipped over and got broken legs, and so they had to be destroyed. But normally they were all okay.
The guns were also winched aboard into the holds, were they?
Oh, they were all hoisted in, lifted in, yes.
Would they be broken down in... What kind of guns were they?
18-pounder, Mark I. They at that time, they were the latest field gun.
And were they winched aboard in one, or were they broken down?
Oh, no, they just picked the gun up on a sling and dropped them in wagons as well, with all the ammunition and everything in them, ready loaded, into the hold.
And what was your your own and the rest of the battery's crew, the battery, where were you put in the boat?
Well, we parked around on decks and what have you for sleeping. There was no accommodation for individuals. It was just anywhere, as it were.
There were no hammocks?
Oh, no, we had none of that. There was no room for it all.
How were you fed?
Well, mass feeding, of course, same as we would have done normally.
Did you have your Indian cooks with you?
No.
You didn't?
No.
So who did the cooking now?
It was ship's crew. Some of the ship's crew were cooks. And a number of our own people, each unit had its own cooks, already trained and taking up the job, you see. So they organised it all.
How were they? Had they been practising before?
Well, there wasn't much to practise. There was no fancy food, I'll tell you. A khaki dodger, as they called it, was the steak once a day, perhaps, or meat of some kind, stews and what have you. And, of course, once we got to Mesopotamia, it was nothing but stews. There was the ordinary camp kettle was the only thing we had to cook in. What do you call it? 7.5-gallon kettle. So,
when you actually left India, was there any sort of were there any scenes when you were?
None at all. There were nobody in the docks, nobody at all. Even my own parents were in Bombay. They didn't know I was going. I had no means of contacting them either. We weren't allowed to.
What other units were sent off at the same time?
The 63rd, 76th, and 81st batteries. That's a brigade, three batteries. We all went together in the same ship.
Must have been fairly crowded.
It was pretty crowded, yes.
Did you sail in convoy, or were you...
Yes, there was about 25 ships in the convoy altogether, with the Royal Navy in escort, you see. But there wasn't much about in those days, only the Emden. That was one German ship that was at large.
Aware of the Emden threat?
Yes, and it wasn't a very far off us either, I believe. But they never caught up. Anyway, there we were, a whole convoy of ships in the Shatt al-Arab. And the first action was fought at Fayal.
That's where you landed, is it?
We landed just above Fayal. One battery was put off at Fayal, the 76th. And then we, 81st and 2nd, 63rd and 82nd, were put off about 30 miles further up.
Can you describe exactly what happened when you were unloading the guns? Because this wasn't a port you were unloading.
Oh, no, there was no port facilities at all. It was simply the riverbank and the date palms stretching for miles, you know. I don't know if you've seen anything of that country or any pictures of it. It's solid, date palms all the way, both sides.
What, a line or
no, great depth of them.
About how thick?
Oh, I sort of think probably 200 or 300 yards thick, more than that. It depends on the water and draining.
How wide was the river at this
Oh, very
point?
Wide, very wide there, and very fast. I mean, if anything dropped in it was away. You never got it.
How exactly then did you land the artillery?
Well,
it sounds very difficult.
Yes, there was no facilities on the shore at all, except whatever engineers could arrange, sort of a temporary wooden stopping points. That's all for means of throwing a rope onto to hold the dhows that we were put the horses in. These were Arab sailing dhows.
So you loaded the horses from the boat?
Yes, into the dhows. And it was about 6, 8 or 10 horses at a time going out in these dhows.
Did the horses panic at all?
Some of them did. One or two of them jumped overboard and were never recovered, of course, because the stream took them away. But it was an all-night job getting off for us as one unit. And there was no opposition, fortunately.
How did you actually get the guns ashore?
Well, that was all hoisted in, again, lifted out onto these dhows, sailing ships.
Was the dhows strong enough to take the weight of
them? Some of them
guns?
Were, but they brought one sort of barge thing, and that went down with 6 guns in it. We lost that.
Were they never recovered?
No, it was impossible to recover them, but they had others and we replaced them. But that's the sort of problem we had, was the offloading.
Was anybody drowned?
I don't know of anybody going over at all, but if you had fallen in, you would certainly have drowned. The very fast-flowing current at that point in the Shatt al-Arab. And the whole thing was very touchy, of course. Infantry had already been gone ashore in the boats from the ship, you see. And they, poor devils, had to scramble out the best they could. There's no means of stepping onto something to get out, as it were. They had to get up the river bank. It's dreadful. It was just nothing to assist us in any way. Of course, the opposition was light.
How did you yourself get ashore?
I went ashore in the middle of the night somewhere.
Can you remember how?
Yes, in a dhow with some of the horses. And then we had a panic. A lot of the horses got scared and broke loose, and we had to chase around half the night for them in these date palms. But anyway, eventually, all was gathered in, and then a battle took place the following morning from troops who had been loaded, offloaded further down. They came up, and the battle was fought there, like the afternoon of our getting off.
What date did you land?
Well, the infantry landed on the 6th of November, and we must have gone ashore about the 16th or 17th.
1914?
Yes.
Now, this battle you referred to, what was the name of it?
Well, that's a foul fort they took there then, and Smyrna, Sania, and Charles Zane, it's called. Anyway, Sir Arthur Barrett, no, I don't think that's British occupied Basra. We got into Basra on the 22nd of November, after that battle.
Did you play any part in that battle?
No, not my battery.
What was your battery doing during this period of time?
We were getting off the ship and getting through. So the other people had already been landed and were in action.
So they were in action ahead of you?
Yes.
So did you were following up behind them?
Yes, we
and
were.
You weren't involved at all?
No, we went in. We moved into Basra behind them.
What were your first impressions of Mesopotamia then, besides the dangerousness of unloading the boat?
Well, not much, because it was just nothing but desert, apart from the palm groves. And of course, Basra, I mean, it was an Arab town, quite a large town, of course, but built without any previous plan, if you understand. It's one of those things that sort of mushroomed. And so the building, the roads, there were no roads of any kind anywhere in the country. And every time we had to go through any built-up area, the job of turning around any corner very often took a house down. We couldn't get around with our guns, you know.
Was this not unpopular with the local
inhabitants? No, and there it was. But there were no made-up roads or anything, because there's no metallic substance anywhere there for building roads.
What was the weather like at this point when you landed?
It was dry, but at that time of year, liable to rain, of course, in the winter months.
Was it any hotter than it had been in India?
No, we didn't notice, because that's the cooler period in the winter months.
What was the next thing that you were involved with then, following Basra?
Well, after we settled in Basra, the Gurna battle business came up, and we sent off. I went up with a section to Gurna, and the Battle of Gurna took place on the 9th of December.
Could you did you play any part? This is the first battle of Gurna.
First, yes, that's right, and my battery were in that.
Could you describe exactly what happened to you and
well,
to your battery?
Well, I mean, we went up on these Lynch boats overnight, landed at dawn the next day, and prepared for an attack, which took place, I think, a couple of days afterwards, because the Royal Navy were already there in their ships, some old ships they had in the Gulf. And so they were able to take part partially, and we did the land advance, of course. That's where I was telling you that we opened fire on a Mirage.
Could you describe this?
Yes, this is actual fact. The battery opened out, and observers gave a certain range or what have you, and two shots were fired, but nothing happened. So after a further observation, I suppose they discovered there was nothing there. But it was due to mirage. And we got there, moved up, we saw our own shallows.
What did they thought they were shooting at?
I have no idea what it was. It was just that they suddenly discovered what they thought was a target. But I should think not sufficient was known about the area and the place that could happen.
Did you see many mirages? Was it a problem?
It was a problem from time to time, yes, but one got used to it. I mean, you could interpret it, in other words, what was likely to happen. It would wave off, you see.
Did they last for long times, these mirages?
No, they were constantly jumping. It was to do with the sun.
Must have been rather confusing, though, isn't
it? Yes, for artillery and people in observation posts and so on. Yes.
What then happened in the First Battle of Kerner? What exactly did you do?
Well, we opened up and cleared the village, of course. It was burned down, and the Turks were cleared back, but we withdrew because there was no intention to hold it that time.
Your role had been what?
Yourself? Yeah, I was just a trumpeter captain's horse holder and two signallers. I used to hold three horses, you see, besides my own.
And where were you doing this horse holding?
When the guns went into action, I grabbed the horses when these people dismounted and returned to the rear with the wagons, you see.
Where exactly had the battery gone into action? Can you describe it?
No, it's just open desert.
And they were firing into the town of Kerner?
Into the Kerner village, yes. And, of course, then a fortnight or a month after, no, less than that, there was a proper set to, and we took the village properly. It was burned down twice, really.
That was on the left bank. In the first action, were you under any return fire at all, your battery?
Yes, not much, though. They were 15-pounder guns they had, the Turks, very old type, and not much of a worry, really.
Were you scared at all in your first action?
No, I think it was all sort of excitement, really, in a sense, I don't know. Not knowing what was to happen, of course. Infantry would be a bit different for them, especially advancing in open desert, which is not very funny.
At what range were you firing at the Turks?
I couldn't tell you offhand, but it must have been about 2,000 or 3,000 yards, I suppose.
So, invisibility range?
Yes, you could see what we were